have high caseload and active community spread. Just like we're asking people not to go to bars, not to have household parties, not to create large spreading events, we're asking people to distance learn at this moment so we can get this epidemic under control.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. As the coronavirus continues to make its way across the country, school districts nationwide are scrambling to create plans that will work for staff members, students, and parents. And while the health of students is the main concern this semester, many parents are also worried about their children falling behind academically. Last week, New York City, the largest school district in the country, announced its plans for reopening schools, which include closing classrooms rather than entire school buildings if a student or teacher becomes sick. Those plans were strongly criticized by the Justice Caucus of the New York City Teachers Union, which called them, quote, confusing and absolutely frightening. And at least one other school district in the United States is already serving as a cautionary example. A student at a junior high school in Greenfield, Indiana, tested positive for coronavirus on the first day of in-person learning last week. And now some families are learning to create learning or pandemic pods, alternative education systems for their children. Some families are pooling resources to pay private teachers or babysitters. Others are splitting the education work among themselves. But these pods will be shaped by the resources families have at their disposal. And some experts say that they have the potential to increase inequality in the education system. And we asked you if you're considering educational options like learning pods for your children.
Hi, this is Tracy from Alameda. We have about 12 kids between the ages of 6 and 12 on our street. And they've been playing together through the whole pandemic, and we're considering having backyard classes to keep these kids together so they don't have to go back to school.
Hey, my name is Skylar Davis. I'm from Bradenton, Florida. I am a nanny for a family that is considering one of these pods for their kids' education. I was homeschooled, so I'm all for it, and if that's what we've got to do to get kids in a good education, if they can't go back to school, at least have them do some socializing and have them give the parents a break.
My name is Chris. I live in Barrie, Vermont. We prefer to homeschool. We're not going to send our children to public school so they can get coronavirus and spread it to everybody in my family.
This is Alexis from Marin County, California. My seventh grader was invited to two pods, but she did well with remote learning. The pod cost would be about $2,000 per child each month, and I want to give the teachers a chance to succeed instead of assuming it won't be a structured academic year.
This is Cheryl Lynn calling from Seattle. Regarding forming pods with kids and other children as an alternative to school, the concept just furthers educational inequality and ableism. How does a pod accommodate students receiving special ed services?
8778-MY-TAKE is our number. Keep telling us your stories. For more on education pods and the way forward for kids this fall, I have Prudence Carter, professor and dean of the Graduate School of Education at Berkeley, where she focuses on education inequality. Prudence, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Christina Samuels, associate editor for Education Week, covering educational equity. Christina, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me as well.
Christina, how expensive could some of these options end up being? We just heard $2,000 a month per kid. Is that about right?
Sure. Well, you know, I think it varies quite a lot. Some parents are definitely looking at having teachers really come in and provide instruction. And certainly when you're talking about that, you're going to be going on the upper end of the varying costs here. But this does range all the way down to maybe parents just saying, you know, can we bring in a babysitter or some teen or young adult who might just be able to supervise our children while they go through whatever the district has planned for them. And in that case, you might be having, a smaller cost, but obviously there's still resources that need to be expended for this.
And Christina, just in terms of are what we're hearing right now anecdotal stories, or are there any data on how many parents might be considering leaving public school districts to pay private teachers to create these pods?
I think that at this point, what we have here is a lot of anecdotes. Now, of course, you know, I mean, the conversation is strong. It's going on in you know, lots of places in the country. But I think it's going to take a little while for us to know how this actually plays out in terms of school enrollment, because it is meaningful, you know, and disruptive, even in the midst of all this disruption, to actually disenroll your child from school. So I have a feeling that, you know, that's going to be something that'll have to shake out, you know, as we start to get student counts. Usually that's in sort of like the late September, October timeframe, when districts have to really report how many students do we have enrolled.
Prudence, for parents who are planning to leave their children in school, for parents who are planning to use pods, how could that deepen certain inequities in our school system?
Well, first, it will deepen inequities if those kids who come from economically vulnerable communities do not have access to this kind of supplemental support. And in some ways, it's primary support. So if you have parents with means, with more affluence, who are actually getting this kind of small group learning for their kids, and you have other kids who actually won't have access to a better quality instruction or supplemental instruction, then you're compounding what we already call academic disparities, or some people refer to them as achievement gaps.
And Prudence, I've seen, you know, on Facebook, I've seen some groups emerge that are specifically for students and parents of color. We know that in a recent national poll done by Axios and Ipsos, Black and Latino parents said they were far more likely to consider it risky to send their kids back to school this fall. But Prudence, how do those factor into what we're seeing with the creation of these pods? I mean, do we see that there will also be racial inequities magnified as a result of this?
Well, so there are two things to say about that. First, we don't know the extent, and this is a concern of mine, that most of the attention focused on learning pods has been focused on middle and upper class families. It may very well be the case that in economically vulnerable communities, there are things happening. We know that nonprofit organizations are actually creating, some are creating learning hubs, which may be slightly larger than pods, but there is equity work going on the ground in various communities around the country. So that's the first thing. The second thing, when it comes to race, it is the case that more families who identify as Black and Brown or of color are more likely to prefer to be at home, but we have class variation as well. So middle class and upper class Black and Brown families may have more means to actually have their own learning pods or pandemic pods, and you may have families with lesser means who may not be able to do that. So it's hard to just say blanketly what's going to happen in terms of race, and this is a point that I've made, that we should not be conflating race and class, because people like myself who are middle, upper middle class can't afford to do it, and some of us are subscribing to the idea that we may want to create small learning pods in our own communities.
Christina, what about regulation for homeschool curriculums? I'm wondering, because there are parents who are just saying, you know what, forget the pods, I'm just going to homeschool my child myself. And one of the things I'm seeing is a lot of sharing of resources, particularly on Facebook groups. People will say, look, there's a great yoga class, or here's a great mindfulness curriculum, or here's a wonderful unschooling curriculum. But that feels to me like there is no standard homeschool curriculum, that your kid could basically learn anything. Is that right?
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, a great deal of variation in the states about what actually entails homeschooling. Some states do have a little bit more, you know, sort of oversight into this than others. But yeah, I mean, the whole, you know, reason behind homeschooling is that, you know, this is a family that is actively wanting to disengage from what the school system has to offer. I think in this case, though, at least what might be driving it here is not necessarily sort of a philosophical opposition to what school is offering, what the, you know, traditional districts are offering, but just the logistics of what districts are beginning to ask of parents. We had a taste of what that would look like in the spring. And now many districts are coming back and saying, like, okay, well, what you were doing in the spring, but longer, you know, several more hours, how about that? And I think that people are just saying, they're not trying to say like, well, we no longer want to teach our children math. They're just trying to say, how can we handle however many hours of synchronous learning in our day and also work at the same time? And I think that that might be the energy that would be driving homeschooling, not a rejection of the academics of districts, but just sort of a rejection of this specific implementation of distance learning.
Prudence, I want to drill down a little bit more on your previous point concerning race and class, because we do know that a lot of the folks, I'm thinking about the folks who are considered essential workers, particularly those who are working in transportation or in food service and the like, who are low-wage workers often, or a lower middle class, working class folks, who may not be able to stay home at all, who will have to send their children off to school. Doesn't this have the potential to further these economic inequalities, if that's the case? And also potentially health inequities, too. If you're forced to send your kid to school and can't protect them at home, don't they also run a higher risk of getting sick?
Absolutely. I mean, I absolutely agree with you. And the reason it's important to think about this, if the schools are not open, what happens to those kids? That's just the bottom line. And many of those parents have always been working during this pandemic for the last 5 months or so. They have been working, and their children, many of them, have been at home. It is the case that in some districts across the country, some communities, there are some who are trying to pick up the slack and try to support those families. But those children are the ones who are most at risk for falling further behind, if we want to use that phrase, but for actually not getting the kind of access to quality instruction or even sustained instruction, like kids who will be a part of these learning pods or whose parents can work at home. So they are definitely challenged. Those families are challenged. And another thing that people don't talk about, because it is probably too difficult to talk about, parents have to consider, those who are forming learning pods have been talking about how to be more inclusive in terms of kids who come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. And they are also aware that those kids are also at higher risk for the virus because their parents are frontline or essential workers. And so then you're having parents and communities wrestling with that question when the pods have been a reaction to trying to kind of minimize to the extent possible one's risk of getting the virus.
Christina, you've spoken to parents about doing this. Are many of them conscious of the potential that learning pods have to create a more unequal system in our education right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, what the protest this summer really did was, elevate the issues of equity in parents' mind that, you know, some of them probably were already there, but some of them really hadn't perhaps thought about this. And there's definitely memes that you see going around saying, well, parents, you know, if you put Black Lives Matter on your, you know, social media stream or something like that, but now you're planning to, gather all your kids together in a pandemic pod, you know, what does that say about you? So, you know, what I've seen, at least in some parents' conversation, is like wrestling with these really deep, thorny issues of equity. And who are we, who knows about our pod? Who are we inviting to our pod? Should we sponsor a child for our pod? Should we, just all these kinds of really fraught conversations, but I do think there's consciousness of it there. But I will say that, you know, one thing also to note is that, you know, we're writing about this, you know, sort of this middle class phenomenon of families coming together for this. But, you know, as Dr. Carter has mentioned, families, you know, this is something that requires us all to rely on all of our networks. And this is not something that's necessarily a class issue. I have a friend who is a teacher who is a teacher of low income students from low income families. And she says she often, when she would start her class, there would be like a couple of kids there. Because these families, somebody would have to work, so they drop the kids off at somebody else's house who has internet connections. That's a pod of sorts. People are trying to do the best they can in a really challenging situation.
Let's talk about funding for schools, Prudence. What does funding need to look like in the fall so that schools that have the resources could have the resources they need to support families who cannot afford to pay for this extra care?
Well, some of the things that we have to consider if kids are going to go back into schools, particularly, is that the schools have the sufficient resources for PPE, for safety, for health and safety, that's first. And so, and it also is the case for social distancing. Will there need to be extra personnel, more teachers, teachers' aides, teachers' assistants? Will they have to be monitors in school? And in addition, you have to think about extra after-school care for these families. If the parents are still working, what kinds of programs will need to be developed? And some schools have those programs attached to their school program. Will there be sufficient funds? And for at the moment, we know that there's not a lot of support that's actually coming to local school districts. So this is a logistical nightmare and so a challenge and a nightmare for so many districts to think about what we can actually do. And knowing that this additional level for many districts that are already cash strapped, this additional level of challenge is one that is really something that has to be thought through. And people are doing it on the same budget. It's not like there's been an infusion of resources since the COVID-19 pandemic.
You know, Prudence, one thing I think about being in New York City, I have a 6-month-old and I keep thinking, my God, just getting into kindergarten in New York City is almost as competitive as getting into Harvard. How competitive is it going to be getting into some of these pods if this is the way we're headed, Prudence?
Well, for the designer pods that you mentioned earlier, there may be competition, but competitive, if they're pods and we're talking about competitive, I mean, I imagine that pods can't be more than, you know, 5 to 6 families, if that. In my mind, I'm thinking 2 to 3. I mean, health and safety have to be first. I mean, someone actually tweeted at me yesterday, no pods, absolutely no pods, because we can't afford to continue to transmit and spread the COVID-19 virus. So if you have a really big pod, it kind of defeats the purpose. We might as well be back in school. I can't imagine that, what competition looks like is who's going to have access to and try to hoard, as some social scientists call, the teachers who may be available to teach or the tutors. That's where the competition is, Tanzina, in terms of trying to get the resources to support the pod.
Christina, in terms of the parents that you've talked to who are considering this or thinking about how equitable it is there any, are there any tips for parents who want to create pods but who also want to keep that level of equity in mind?
So there was a couple of interesting, things that I was hearing from parents. And I'll just say, you know, at this point, we don't know how successful any of this will be. But one, suggestion I was hearing from one parent was to try to form a pod based on your child's class. So wait until an actual classroom has formed and then you have a student and then you have a list of students there. And then you might create a pod there, because the idea is that the school will have already, you know, naturally have tried to create a balanced classroom. And so from those students, then you can create a more balanced pod. The idea then being that you're not just using your own network, but that you're kind of spreading out a little bit beyond the folks who just your next door neighbors or something like that. I know that some other parents are reaching out to community groups and just other sorts of entities just to make sure that they are letting a broad group of parents know, hey, you know, this is an option that's being discussed. So those are some ideas that I've heard of. And then, you know, I think another idea was just to say, you know, if the issue is the socialization, just sort of stick with that as opposed to hiring a teacher.
Parents doing a lot, as always. Christina Samuels is an associate editor for Education Week covering educational equity, and Prudence Carter is a professor and the dean of the Graduate School of Education at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.